Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Monday, November 21st. I'm your reader, Kelly Neff. Let's begin with a look at the weather. For today, partly sunny. Expect a high of 39 and a low tonight of 18. Tomorrow, mostly sunny. A high of 42, a low of 27. Then on Wednesday, partly sunny, a high of 43, a low of 31. On Thursday, look for a chance of rain or snow, a westerly wind at 10 to 20 miles per hour, a high of 40, and a low of 26. Now a look at today's top weather story from meteorologist Corey Thompson. As the skies go deeper into autumn and rapidly approach meteorological winter, normal temperatures lose a degree every few days. Our record of the warmest highs for each day also will slip, and soon will turn it back on its 70s with one key exception. November 24th is the last day this month with a record high of at least 70 degrees, having reached 71 in 2017. Beyond that date, we traditionally have never seen a high at or above 70 until February 15th, when we reached 73 degrees back in 1921. That was true until last year, when the exceptional storm system that produced the derecho on December 15th set that day's record at 73 degrees. Outside of that one, 70s are nearly impossible for the next 2 months. That's your top weather story from meteorologist Corey Thompson. Let's go to the front page of the Cedar Rapids Gazette, where there's a story written by Grace King, says CR School's next leader must drive achievement. Dateline, Cedar Rapids. Educators and residents want to see the next superintendent of the Cedar Rapids Community School District be someone with experience in leading a diverse school district, be good at relationship building, and have a proven track record of student achievement. A profile of desired characteristics in a superintendent is being presented to the Cedar Rapids School Board today as the board aims to identify the district's next leader as early as January. The profile was compiled by Hazard, Young, Atiyah and Associates, an Illinois firm selected by the board last month to identify candidates to become the next superintendent. The district hosted more than 20 in-person community, parent, and student input sessions earlier this month by invitation only. The district emailed invitations to more than 12,000 families and students, 2,500 staff, 24 civic leaders, 48 community partners, and 46 community leaders. Four virtual community input sessions also were held earlier this month, and a survey sent out to gather perceptions of the school district and determine the desired characteristics of the new superintendent, according to a district newsletter. The survey was completed by 1,040 people, including 394 teachers, 335 parents, 162 support staff, 96 community members, and 44 administrators. Of those who responded, 844 marked that they were white, 134 didn't say, 19 were black, 14 were Hispanic or Latino, 10 were two or more races, 7 were Asian, 3 were Pacific Islanders, and 1 was Native American or Alaska Native. Based on the data collected, residents want to see a superintendent who fosters a positive professional climate of mutual trust and respect among faculty, staff, and administrators, recruits, employs, and retains effective personnel throughout the district, provides transparent communication, and understands and is sensitive to the needs of a diverse student population. In the multiple-choice survey, respondents responded that the strengths of the district include technology integration into the classroom, employing effective staff, providing a clear vision for the future, educators who address individual learning needs, and working to close achievement and opportunity gaps. School board members responded that they are looking for someone who is an effective communicator, is a visible and approachable member of the community, can lead diversity and equity initiatives as it relates to human resources and student achievement, and is committed to staying with the district for a significant period. Former Superintendent Noreen Bush died October 23rd. She had been diagnosed with cancer more than 2 years ago. Art Sathoff, the retired superintendent of the Indianola Community School District, was named interim superintendent last month by a 6-1 vote. Sathoff's contract calls for the $167,000 salary through June 30th, as well as benefits. From the Iowa Today page is a story written by Trish Mahaffey of the Gazette. CR man who beat and robbed older Coggin couple gets 60 years in prison. Dateline, Cedar Rapids. A Coggin woman said Friday the nightmare that changed her life began when a man came to her door around 6:30 the night of January 9th, identifying himself as a police investigator. In a victim impact statement, 72-year-old Sandra Henderson said she and her husband, 73-year-old Joseph, soon realized that 33-year-old Brandon Lee of Cedar Rapids wasn't there for any investigation. She felt immediate fear and attempted to call 911, but the man pointed a gun at her head. Henderson said her husband, who had cancer and dementia, put up a fight and suffered while trying to protect her, their home, and his dignity. The man stole money from them and damaged their home. She knows the beating impacted her husband's remaining months. He died of cancer a few months after the assault. Joseph Henderson suffered facial fractures, and Sandra Henderson had a deep laceration to her head. A Linn County jury found Lee guilty in July of 2 counts each of first-degree robbery and willful injury, and 1 count each of first-degree theft and impersonating a police officer. On Friday, 6th Judicial District Judge Christopher Bruns, calling Lee's actions and behavior heinous, inexcusable, and predatory conduct, sentenced him to 60 years in prison. He faced up to 77 years, but Bruns ran some of the sentences concurrently. Lee must serve a minimum of 30 years before being eligible for parole. During sentencing, Lee apologized to Sandra Henderson and members of her family who attended the hearing. He said he was remorseful and thinks about what he did every day. He said, "I'm terribly sorry for any pain I've caused you. I'm truly sorry. I wish I could take it back what I did, but I can't." Henderson, in her statement, said she didn't believe Lee had remorse. He never admitted to taking the money from their safe and never returned the money. Lee wasn't remorseful at trial, she said. Assistant Linn County Attorney Rena Schulte called the assault a premeditated attack on a defenseless couple. "This wasn't Lee's first rodeo," she said, pointing to his previous convictions and prison time. Schulte said there was no reason for this level of violence. He had a gun and fired it during the incident. Jeremy Elgis, Lee's lawyer, said his client was using drugs heavily, which was the driving force behind the crime. Lee's sobriety is important to him now, and he wants to be a different person going forward. Elgis asked the judge to run all the sentences concurrently for a total of 25 years. Also from the Iowa Today page is one just written by the Gazette staff. The headline says, "Iowa City expanding where sidewalk cafes are allowed." Opportunities to eat outdoors in Iowa City might increase once warmer weather returns. The Iowa City Council last Tuesday unanimously voted to expand where sidewalk cafes are allowed. This was the ordinance's first consideration. It will need to be approved 2 more times. Currently, sidewalk cafes are allowed downtown and in the Riverfront Crossings District. The council voted in favor of allowing sidewalk cafes without a liquor license outside of these areas to operate. According to a city memo, the intention is to encourage more sidewalk cafes throughout the community. Assistant City Manager Rachel Kilberg said the cafes would be required to still abide by our sidewalk cafe ordinance and policy, as well as any other additional restrictions that staff or the city manager may see fit. For example, if you have a coffee shop operating in maybe a more residential neighborhood, maybe the hours of operation need to be reduced. The City Council heard an update about the Sidewalk Cafe program at its September 6th work session, along with recommended changes to support a successful Sidewalk Cafe environment. Expanding where Sidewalk Cafes are allowed was among the recommendations. Other recommendations are anticipated to come before the Council at a December 6th meeting. The Iowa City Council also last Tuesday unanimously adopted a land acknowledgement statement recognizing the indigenous populations and their traditional territories. Council member Janice Weiner drafted the resolution, which was informed by similar land acknowledgement statements adopted by other institutions. Weiner said it was long past time that we honor those on whose land we live and thrive. Weiner said, "It's an essential part of our history, and I think that if we've learned anything over the past few years, it should be that we must learn from, accept, and acknowledge our past, and allow it to inform our present and our future." City staff will post the land acknowledgement statement on the city's website and develop ways to incorporate it when people are reading the City Council agendas or entering council chambers. The Marion City Council has awarded the 11 additional small businesses a combined $106,844 through its Business Innovation and Support Grant. The Council voted to allocate the funds provided by the American Rescue Plan during a meeting on Thursday. Earlier this year, the Council awarded 20 businesses funding in the program's first round, totaling $293,156. The program is being administered as a partnership between the city and the Chamber of Commerce. Marion Mayor Nick Ablaski said, "Small businesses are the headstone of our local economy. We are pleased to award ARPA funds to such businesses who were significantly impacted by the pandemic and support them as they continue to recover. The grants are for small businesses with 1 to 10 employees. They provide funding ranging from $5,500 to a little over $10,000, and each award comes up with up to 5 hours of mandatory business counseling by a business coach. The second round awardees include Epic Salon, Tommaso's Pizza, Salon Bellezza, Monroe & Company, Sugar Me, AM Glass Repair LLC, Master Auto Repair Incorporated, Staged Dwellings, New York Gyro, Puddle Jumpers, and La Cantina Bar & Grill. Meanwhile, Cedar Rapids is working to build 3 fishing piers that will be completely accessible for individuals with disabilities to use at Prairie Park Fishery. The piers will have cantilevered decks that extend beyond the water's edge, according to the city. The decks are designed so that people of all mobilities are able to fish in deeper waters over the lake or along the banks. Pier users will have amenities that are fully compliant with the Americans with Disabilities Act, from the parking lot to the water. Parks Superintendent Mitch Aronson told the Parks, Recreation, and Waterways Commission this week that staff anticipate the piers will be complete this month, coinciding with when the lake is stocked by the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. The new piers are part of the city's ongoing effort to improve accessibility of the municipal park system. Improvements are underway in the Southeast Parks Quadrant for a price tag of $2 million. The city reports that more than $4.9 million in improvements have been made in the Northeast and Northwest quadrants. And finally, Ellis Golf Course, Twin Pines Golf Course, and Mini Pines Miniature Golf Course have closed for the season. The city of Cedar Rapids announced last week that Gardner Golf Course had already closed. The Ellis Pro Shop will remain open through December 23rd for holiday shopping, though. Holiday hours are 9 till 4:30 p.m. Monday through Friday and 9 to 3 Saturday. It will be closed Thursday and Friday for Thanksgiving. From the top stories page of the Gazette, we have a story written by Clark Coffin. Suspended employee waved gun inside CR nursing home. A suspended employee of Heritage Specialty Care in Cedar Rapids brought a gun to work in September and waved it in the air while threatening to, quote, take care of a problem with a colleague, according to state inspectors. Two workers who witnessed the incident did not immediately report it, but first went to another meeting and then to lunch. State records indicate that a nurse aide at Heritage came to work about 10 o'clock the morning of September 26th to give a written statement related to an argument she had with another staff member the night before. That argument had resulted in the aide being suspended. When the aide entered the nursing home, she had her hood up and sunglasses on that workers later told police about. While speaking to the home's scheduling coordinator and a human resources employee about the argument, the aide allegedly became very upset and pulled a small firearm from her purse. The aide allegedly waved the gun in the air without aiming it at anyone and said, quote, if you don't handle it, I'll take care of it myself. She eventually placed the gun back in her purse, according to inspectors. The staff coordinator and human resources worker then left the aide in an office, went to another meeting, and then left for lunch. While at lunch, the two discussed the incident and decided it probably should be reported up the chain of command. While the two were at lunch, the aide, presumably still around, left the building. After lunch, the staff notified the administrator of the incident, and the facility went into lockdown. The aide was fired and barred from re-entering the building, and the home established a police presence in or around the building for a full week. According to inspectors, police told Heritage officials they could not charge anyone with a crime because the aide did not threaten anyone, according to the inspector's report. The staff coordinator and human resources worker were later given verbal education regarding the necessity of reporting a firearm immediately. However, the human resources worker denied this, telling inspectors that she, quote, never received re-education or discipline in the wake of the incident. She also told inspectors and police that while she never felt threatened, the gun incident did leave her feeling concerned for the safety of the residents. The home's interim director of nursing told inspectors an investigation into the incident was never completed. Heritage is owned and managed by Care Initiatives of West Des Moines. Care Initiatives has not responded to requests for comment. While inspectors were at Heritage investigating the matter, they also looked into several other complaints and self-reported incidents. The home was cited for 6 regulatory violations, including failure to meet professional standards, failure to keep the home free of hazards, insufficient nursing staff, and failure to follow federal guidelines on COVID by the COVID-19 vaccinations. A state fine of $9,500 has been proposed, but held in suspension so the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services can determine whether to impose a federal penalty. According to the report, the inspectors reported that while they were at home in October, they heard someone yelling for help. And upon investigating, they found a female resident who said her call light had gone unanswered for more than 40 minutes while she waited for assistance in getting to the bathroom. In addition, the inspectors found that one employee had worked 348 hours and two others had worked 30 hours and 97 hours, respectively, without proof of a COVID-19 vaccination or an approved request for exemption. The business office manager admitted to the inspector that two of the home's unvaccinated workers had not even requested an exemption. In the previous 4 months, 8 workers at Heritage had tested positive for COVID-19. In addition, 22 residents had tested positive for COVID-19 in September and October. Earlier this year, Heritage Specialty Care was cited for the financial exploitation of a resident and for using untrained caregivers. State inspectors say the exploitation involved a worker who allegedly took $1,625 from a resident with a spinal cord injury and then taunted the man with text messages referring to him as, quote, a vegetable and veggie boy. Six other Iowa nursing homes run by Care Initiatives have been cited for major violations in recent weeks. They face fines up to $80,250, and additional penalties may yet be imposed by CMS. Also on the top stories page is one written by John McLaughlin of the Gazette. Sheriff's Office in Jones County identifies girl killed in Onslow house fire. The Jones County Sheriff's Office has released the name of a child killed Friday in a house fire in Onslow. 10-year-old Jania Morgan was found by firefighters in an upstairs bedroom at 205 Summit Street. Fire crews had made multiple attempts to reach her, but were unsuccessful due to the intensity of the fire and heat on both floors of the residence, according to a news release. Her body was taken to the Iowa State Medical Examiner's Office in Ankeny, pending an autopsy. The release stated that Jania was a fifth-grade student in the Midland School District. The district has crisis staff available. Her mother and four children, aged 1 through 8, were able to escape through a bedroom window on the main floor of the home, and all were taken to the Jones Regional Medical Center in Anamosa with smoke and heat-related injuries. The 1-year-old girl was transported to the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics for further treatment and was released Friday night. A preliminary investigation by the state Fire Marshal's Office and Jones County Sheriff's Office determined the fire to be accidental, starting in the kitchen. Authorities are continuing to investigate the fire. Jania's death was the 7th Iowa house fire fatality over 3 days this past week. 4 children died Wednesday in a house fire in Mason City, and a retired couple, 72-year-old Charles Osterkamp and 70-year-old Sherry Osterkamp, died in a Friday fire in their home in northeast Cedar Rapids. They were pulled from the basement after a neighbor saw smoke coming from the house and called 911. Now we go to the Insight page, where we have a guest column written by Norman Sherman of Coralville, who's worked extensively in politics, including as Vice President Hubert Humphrey's press secretary. Norman says, I've been giving advice to Republicans for a long time. Usually I'm in a chair in front of a television screen and alone. No one in the room ever questions my wisdom, but the Republicans don't ever follow my screamed suggestions. As a concerned citizen, however, I feel obligated to continue to evaluate their candidates for president. The 2024 caucuses and primaries across the country are obviously not imminent, but tourism in Iowa will increase dramatically beginning soon. If you look like a Republican, watch carefully when you shut the front door. One of a dozen candidates you barely know may grab you. Worse yet, of course, it could be humble Donald Trump, who surprised us all by announcing he will run again, telling us on social media a day earlier, quote, hopefully tomorrow will turn out to be one of the most important days in the history of our country. He really did say that. We can expect visits from others as well. Mike Pence, Nikki Haley, Tom Cotton, Tim Scott, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, Larry Hogan, Mike Pompeo, Josh Hawley, and Ron DeSantis. I may have missed a couple who have hinted they may run. Of all those peddlers of conservative solutions, Ron DeSantis seems to have already captured the lead. He is a breath of stale air. He just won a smashing re-election as governor of Florida, winning by 19 points over a former governor. That is not surprising, since he has been anointed. Here's his blasphemy in a paid ad. Quote, God looked down on his planned paradise and said, I need a protector. So God made a fighter. That fighter is DeSantis, the governor who will serve the people and save their jobs, their livelihoods, their liberty, their happiness. End quote. They say that God did it on the 8th day, and I say he should have taken the day off after an arduous week. Many politicians think they were chosen, not just called the lead, but they don't quite say it. DeSantis apparently believes it and is willing to share his inspired endorsement. We will see him in Iowa more than once in months ahead. We will see a mini-Trump ideologically, but one who has already offended his secular leader and drawn the wrath of Trump. Sooner or later, all the others will too, of course, but Ron leads the way. DeSantis is proud of his anti-abortion success in Florida and his "don't say gay" in class as he meddles in education. It is not yet clear how he and the others will deal with the midterm exodus. Even in a Republican caucus, women and the young may look for a leader less cemented in yesterday. It will be slightly more fun than watching the corn grow. Trump now reacts to any perceived slight and cannot accept his right to remain silent. Sadly, in winner-take-all elections, he is likely to win if the others split the vote among several of them. My TV is off, but here is my advice for the Republican Party. Regain your soul. When you leave Iowa in the spring of 2024, leave it with someone who is not Trump or Trumpian. Otherwise, you invite a second blue wave. That would possibly make it a great day and worth all my earlier screaming at you. That's from Norman Sherman of Coralville, who's worked extensively in politics, including as Vice President Hubert Humphrey's press secretary. We have three community letters today. One is from Gary Sanders of Iowa City. Gary says, "It was a warm, sunny, early morning in July. I wanted to start the day listening to a beautiful song. I sat down in front of my computer and Googled one of my all-time favorites, Tammy Wynette singing Don't Touch Me Unless You Love Me. I sat back and closed my eyes, but the first thing I heard was someone yelling, 'Christina Bohannon is liar!' I was horrified. I hit the mute button and very slowly calmed down. But I didn't try to listen to that song again this morning, and I have not been able to listen to that song since that day. Now that the election is behind us and the political advertising is done for the year, I would very much appreciate it if Representative Marionette Miller Meeks, or one of her staffers, contacts me and tells me what exactly Bohannon was lying about and why it was necessary to shout it in my ear while I was trying to listen to Tammy Wynette's beautiful voice on a warm, sunny morning in July." And that's a letter from Gary Sanders of Iowa City. We have another one from Stephen Picorni of Urbandale that says, "Love is blind to skin color, sexual orientation, and gender identity. The Defense of Marriage Act was a callous attempt to refute that fundamental reality. It deserved to be overturned. It's what the vast majority of Americans have resoundedly said they wanted done. So thank you, Senator Joni Ernst, for your vote to Deep Six, this decidedly unevil or uncivil piece of legislation." Our other letter comes from Eric C. Lindstrom, the executive director of Farm Animal Rights Movement, who says, "While the world watches COP27 unfold in Egypt, I'm reminded of when climate change threatens world food supply was making headlines, prompted by the release of a summary report by the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. The report points out what COP27 overlooks. The IPCC report detailed how climate change is threatening the world food and water supplies, turning arable land to desert, degrading soil, and increasing devastating weather effects. It concluded that avoiding starvation and mass migrations requires fundamental changes in current animal agriculture and land management practices, which account for 23% of human-caused greenhouse gas emissions. The conclusions of the report matched closely those by Oxford University in 2017 and by Chatham House in 2015. A UN report on 2010 blamed animal agriculture for 19% of greenhouse gas emissions, 70% of fresh water use, and 38% of land use. All reports recommend a shift to plant-based eating. In an environmentally sustainable world, meat and dairy products in our diet must be replaced by plant-based options, just as fossil fuels are replaced by wind, solar, and other pollution-free energy sources. There are so many alternatives to meat and dairy available today that we owe it to our planet to make a change." And that's a community letter from Eric C. Lindstrom, the executive director of Farm Animal Rights Movement. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Monday, November 21st, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. First, we take a look at what's called the other notices, the smaller, shorter notices, from Clarence. 75-year-old William D. Walters died Friday, November 18th. The Chapman Funeral Home in Clarence is in charge of those arrangements. From Kyoto, 74-year-old Michael Harper died Friday, November 18th. Assisting the family will be the Home Funeral Home of Sigourney. From Malcolm, 86-year-old Phyllis LaVon McMains died Friday, November 18th. The Kloster Funeral Home in Brooklyn will be in charge of those arrangements. And other deaths, 64-year-old Robert Norman Wheeler of Webster, Wisconsin, formerly of Hiawatha, died Friday, November 18th. Assisting the family will be the Murdoch Funeral Service and Cremation Service of Marion. Now for the longer obituaries, 73-year-old Sandra Jean Allen of Cedar Rapids went home to be with the Lord on Thursday, November 17th, with her family by her side. Friends may visit with the family from 4 to 6 p.m. Wednesday, November 23rd at Tehan Funeral Home with the time for reflection and sharing from 6 to 7 p.m. Frieda Iris Rabick, age 91 of Cedar Rapids, died Thursday, November 17th. A visitation will be held from 12:30 to 2 p.m. Tuesday, November 22nd at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids. A memorial service will follow at 2 p.m. Tuesday at the funeral home. Burial at Czech National Cemetery in Cedar Rapids will take place at a later date. Joseph James Yukovich, age 82 of Tipton, entered eternity on Friday, November 18th, while under the care at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. A memorial mass will be held at 11 o'clock Tuesday morning, November 22nd, at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Tipton, with visitation at the church from 10 to 11 a.m. Claire J. Sharp, age 82 of Cedar Rapids, went to the Lord on Thursday, November 17th. A visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Monday, November 21st, with a prayer service beginning at 3 p.m. at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids. Funeral Mass will take place at 10 o'clock Tuesday morning, November 22nd, at St. Jude Catholic Church in Cedar Rapids, with a visitation 1 hour prior. Burial will follow at St. Joseph's Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. A luncheon will follow the burial at St. Jude Catholic Church Parish Hall. In lieu of flowers and plants, memorials may be directed to the Willis Dady Shelter, Discovery Living, Mercy Catherine's Cupboard, or a charity of the donor's choice. Joanne L. Svec, S-V-E-C, age 83, passed away with her family by her side November 18th. A visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, November 22nd at Cedar Memorial Funeral Home. A funeral service will be held at 10 o'clock Wednesday morning, November 23rd, at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. Entombment will immediately follow. Instead of flowers, memorials may be made to the Alzheimer's Association or the Cedar Valley Humane Society. Joanne Frederick Dietz, age 82 of Tipton, entered eternity early Saturday morning, November 19th, while under the care of Cedar Manor Nursing Home in Tipton. Funeral services will be held at 11 o'clock Wednesday morning, November 23rd, at Fry Funeral Home in Tipton. Burial will follow in Shawver Cemetery. Family will receive friends from 10 to 11 a.m. prior to the service. Memorials may be donated to the Friends of the Animals of Tipton or Cedar Manor Nursing Home. Frank Cummings of Solon passed away at his home on November 17th. A memorial mass will be held at 10 o'clock Friday morning, November 25th, at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Solon. Interment will be held at a later date. Memorials may be directed to Iowa City Hospice, Burr Oak Land Trust, or St. Mary's Church in Solon. Looking now at some Eastern Iowa briefs, We have one from Iowa City. Vinton native Elizabeth Moan will hold an album release party at 9 o'clock Saturday night at Gabe's at 330 East Washington Street in Iowa City. Moan's album, called Wherever You Aren't, was released November 11th. The single and video Emotionally Available is out now. The record, which was 2 years in the making, is all about mental health, joy, panic attacks, falling in love, falling out of it, and accepting that sometimes it will stay with you forever. Tickets are $20. From Cedar Rapids, Sober CR, a community of adult non-drinkers, invites you to an evening of education on alcohol-free mocktail options, aligning with many New Year's resolutions of living a healthier lifestyle. This informal event will be held from 6 to 9 p.m. December 13th at Old Neighborhood Pub at 688 16th Street Northeast. Drea Van Hoek, who's the owner of Old Neighborhood Pub, will show participants how to create delicious cocktails without any alcohol. She calls them mocktails. Sober CR is a social support group for the sober and sober curious. The group holds bi-weekly gatherings of dinners, family gatherings, and other events without the pressure of alcohol. From Cedar Rapids, the Genealogical Society of Linn County will host a Christmas open house from 1 till 3 o'clock the afternoon of December 3rd in the Cedar Rapids Area Genealogy Library in the lower level of the Masonic Library at 813 First Avenue Southeast in Cedar Rapids. There will be tours, treats, and door prizes. And a reminder, the Iowa City Public Library will be open from 10 to 5 Wednesday and closed on Thursday for the Thanksgiving holiday. The library will resume regular hours from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. on Friday. The bookmobile will be closed Wednesday through Friday in observance of Thanksgiving. Since it's Monday, we have the Kids Gazette today. So let's take a look at one of the stories there, which is called In U.S. Elections, Why Does It Take So Long to Count Votes? On Tuesday, November 8th, Americans cast their ballots to elect some members of Congress and state and local officials, so it's a big day for the United States democratic system. You may have seen stories or social media posts earlier this month that declare winners, but even in this time of powerful computers and other speedy technology, the election process isn't completed in a few hours or the next day. Gretchen Mock is a professor of industrial engineering at the University of Rhode Island. She talked about why that is. Industrial engineers work on systems and processes. Mock has learned a lot about how election processes work since 2016, when she was asked to help Rhode Island eliminate long voting lines. Mock said, "When we count the votes, that takes time because we want it to be right." She said kids could think about it like turning in homework. She said, "When you rush through that homework, you get it done, but will it be right? Isn't it better to go through it and take your time?" There has been a long tradition of releasing ballot tallies on election night, but those results are unofficial. She said, they are not double and triple checked. Part of the reason is that in the United States, there are many ways to vote and to count the votes. When the Founding Fathers set up the election process, they didn't include many details. They left the times, places, and manner of holding elections of senators and representatives up to state lawmakers, according to the U.S. Constitution. As the nation has grown and technology has developed, the process has become more complicated. Mock says we have 50 different ways of doing things. Each state figures out what it thinks will work for its residents, whether they live in big cities, small towns, or remote areas. Voting times may include casting votes days or weeks in advance and on election day. The places may be a mailbox, a drop box, or assigned polling place in neighborhoods, and the manner could be using paper ballots marked by hand and then scanned, machines that put marks on paper, often from votes marked on a display screen, or machines that feed votes directly into a vote-counting computer system. The hand-marked ballot system is the most widely used. After voters have finished casting ballots, election officials and volunteers have a lot of work to do. Each voting location or precinct needs to secure the ballots, then transfer them to the local elections office. After they do that, the city or county will often post those results on its website. But those results are not official, even if the precincts have finished reporting. What comes next is called canvassing a group of people who may be election officials or members of each majority or political party canvasses or reviews the ballots for possible problems. They make sure poll voters and voters have followed the rules. Macht said, "What if I voted by mail and forgot to sign my envelope? I guess my vote doesn't count." Well, she said some voters do think that. But the system is designed to catch that error. Many states will allow voters to cure or fix that kind of problem so their vote can be counted. But election officials need to contact those people, and voters may need to appear in person. Once the local canvass board is satisfied that all the ballots have been counted properly, local officials review one more time and then certify or make those results official. Most states give counties or cities 1 to 2 weeks to complete this process. California, which has nearly 22 million registered voters, allows up to 30 days. They send local results to the state elections office, which has its own review procedure. After that happens, officials certify the results for the entire state. Sometimes this long process verifies those unofficial results from election night, but in very close elections, a different candidate may end up the winner. There's nothing wrong or suspicious about that. It's just election officials and volunteers making sure their version of homework is as accurate as possible. Macht admits the wait can be frustrating, and she encourages kids to ask questions. She said, "It's exciting, and you want to know the results. Be patient, and if you don't like the process, you can talk to your election official. They want to share that information with you." Also on the Kids Gazette page is a story written by Grace King of the Gazette that says, "Governor supports Iowa's Recycles Day, urges sustainability." As part of a nationwide push to encourage more sustainable living, Governor Kim Reynolds signed a proclamation earlier this month declaring this past Tuesday, November 15th, as Iowa Recycles Day. Reducing, reusing, and recycling waste is important to ensure a cleaner, greener state for future generations, Reynolds said in her proclamation, and went on to say, "On this day, we renew our commitment to making environmentally conscious changes in our lives so that our children and grandchildren can live that better, cleaner future." And for the kids reading the Kids Gazette, recycling is collecting and processing materials that would otherwise be thrown away in the trash and turning them into new products. The city of Cedar Rapids has an easy tool to help with curbside recycling, a bin called Kirby. Kirby is a large blue cart that can easily be wheeled to and from the curb on collection day, according to the City of Cedar Rapids website. Items that can be placed in Kirby include paper, plastic containers, metal, cardboard, glass, which can be recycled but should not be placed in Kirby because it is a safety hazard to recycling crews and workers of the sorting facility. But clear and colored glass can be placed together in a separate bucket with a handle no larger than 5 gallons. Still more on the Kids Gazette page is a story about Prairie High student who earns an uncommon student award. Dateline, Cedar Rapids. Prairie High School senior and member of Linn County 4-H, Ethan Strucker, is one of 5 recipients of a $10,000 scholarship for his hard work as a youth mentor. Strucker is recipient of the Herbert Hoover Uncommon Student Award, a scholarship program for Iowa high school students who are motivated and community-minded, according to a news release earlier this month from Linn County 4-H. The award is named in honor of Herbert Hoover, an Iowa native and the 31st President of the United States. Projects students propose should demonstrate the values that Herbert Hoover exemplified in his life of public service. Grades, test scores, essays, and financial need are not evaluated as part of the award. Strucker was honored for work as a youth mentor for First Lego League, a program for students in 4th through 8th grades to work together to invent new solutions to real-world problems. Students in the program build and program robots using Lego products to compete against other teams in regional, state, and international levels. Strecker gave his time and expertise to a first Lego League team that meets at least weekly during the fall and winter. He also continued to mentor the youth and train them as science, technology, engineering, and math peer leaders throughout the spring and summer. The group attended several community events and day camps for younger students to share their expertise in coding and robotics. A 4-H spokesman said in a news release, "We congratulate Ethan as a positive role model for younger students and for his spirit of volunteerism. It has been a joy for our Linn County 4-H staff and volunteers to guide him and encourage him as he learned through these roles." While many uncommon student projects have a defined beginning and end, some projects continue after students graduate from high school and are eligible for the Mariah Becker Award Volunteer Leadership Award. Strecker applied for and received this award, as well as for leading a first Lego League team in the off-season, teaching and inspiring their peers to explore science, technology, engineering, arts, and math at camps and events. The Mariah Becker Award includes a $500 stipend to be given directly to the organization carrying on the project, which is Linn County 4-H. Also from the Kids Gazette section. We have a story that says, "Group collecting presents for Eastern Iowa children in foster care." Dateline, Cedar Rapids. Families Helping Families of Iowa is collecting donations for presents to give at its Winter Wonderland holiday celebration. The nonprofit organization that helps and supports children in foster care is collecting new toys or gift cards through December 2nd. The suggested value of each toy or gift card is $25. They can be delivered to the Families Helping Families office, which is at 6000 7th Street Southwest in Cedar Rapids. Each December, Families Helping Families hosts a holiday party for over 1,000 members of the foster care community as a part of a vision to create positive opportunities, relationships, and better overall health for youth in Iowa who've been removed from their homes. This festive event includes gifts, food, crafts, Santa Claus, and a visit to Santa's workshop. Financial donations to help buy gifts are also welcome, and donations can be made to the Holiday Toy Drive. Again, that address is 6000 7th Street Southwest in Cedar Rapids. Now, the Winter Wonderland holiday celebration is December 17th this year from 2 to 4 p.m. at the Hawkeye Downs Expo Center. The event is free for children in foster care, those adopted from foster care, and other children living in the foster household. Registration is required, and foster parents and caregivers can register their families on this webpage, FamiliesHelpingFamiliesOfIowa.org. In sports, there's an Iowa Heartlanders story. Losses keep piling up for Iowa. It's written by Jeff Johnson of the Gazette. Dateline Coralville. A lot of good, even if the end result was bad. The Iowa Heartlanders lost Sunday afternoon in a shootout to Kalamazoo at Extreme Arena 4-3. Both shooters for the Wings scored, with both Heartlanders being denied. Iowa rallied from a two-goal hole late in the third period to force extra time. In the end, it's a standings point. Yet, with the hole, the Heartlanders have dug themselves early in the ECHL season. That's not enough. Head coach Derek Damon's post-game demeanor showed disappointment. He said, "There are some positives. We battled back and got a point. But at the end of the day, we've got to come away with the win. There were some people that didn't bring it today, and we'll identify those guys and make adjustments accordingly." Damon stressed he feels his club is making progress. It outshot and outchanced the opponent here, which is a step in the right direction. Iowa's had a lot of roster upheaval the first month plus part of the reason is the 1-7-1-1 record, but the current mix does show promise. Defenseman and captain Reese Zmolek returned to the fold for this game after playing in the American Hockey League with the Rochester Americans for a couple of weeks on a PTO, a player tryout, contract. Iowa traded for goalie Trevin Kozlowski last week, and the 2021-22 Heartlander should form a solid duo with Corbin Kaspersky in net. The teams traded second-period goals yesterday, with Cole Stafford netting Iowa's. Kalamazoo scored twice in the third for a 3-1 lead, one goal coming on a rebound batted out of midair, and the other after a video review. But the Heartlanders tied it with just over 5 minutes left on goals from defenseman Matt Murphy and Yuki Mura just 38 seconds apart. Coach Damon said, "I just like the effort out of our guys today. We battled back and tied it up with time to play. I thought we carried the play for a lot of the game. To me, I thought we were in better shape. Their goalie just played well today, and hats off to him." That would be Evan Cormier, who spent a lot of time in the AHL in his career. He made some point-blank saves in the game, including an OT. The Heartlanders went a full week without playing, getting some much-needed practice time in. There will be zero rest this week as they play Wednesday at Kalamazoo, Friday at Indianapolis, then return home for back-to-backers Saturday and Sunday against Cincinnati. Damon said, "It's the grind of the ECHL. That's why we're conditioned athletes. We work them hard this week for this part coming up here. You've got to take care of yourself. Got to make sure you've got proper rest and proper nutrition so your body can handle the test of 4 games in 5 days. If you're looking for something to do today, here's the column appropriately entitled Things to Do Today. First of all, under health, Jerry Fit classes improve strength, balance, and arthritic conditions for people 60 and older. If you want to register for this event, you can stop in or call 319-848-7616. The event is 8 to 9 a.m. at the Ely Public Library at 1595 Dowes Street in Ely. It's free. A fundraiser benefit HACAP food drive. Bring non-perishable food items and food throughout the month of November for HACAP Food Reservoir. Some of the most requested items include whole wheat pasta, brown rice, canned fruit and juice, nuts and seeds, plus peanut butter. You can do that from 9 a.m. to 8 p.m. today at the Hiawatha Public Library at 150 West Wilman Street. Under health, link movements with our breath and cultivate strength, flexibility, and relaxation through regular Hatha-style yoga classes. That's from 9:30 to 11:45 this morning at the Prairie Woods Franciscan in Hiawatha at 120 East Boysen Road. The cost is $60 for a 6-punch card, $99 for an 11-punch card. Under business, it's a bridge to opportunity. This is an opportunity to learn about the Cedar Rapids Age Friendly Action Plan. It'll be at 1:30 this afternoon at Four Oaks Bridge in Cedar Rapids at 2100 First Avenue Northeast, and the cost is free. Under health, Connection Recovery Support Group. This is a peer-led support group for any adult 18 years of age and older who's experiencing symptoms of a mental health condition. You will gain insight from hearing the challenges and successes of others, and the groups are led by trained leaders who have been there. That will be held from 6 till 7:30 p.m. tonight, and it's at the National Alliance on Mental Illness of Linn County, or NAMI, which is in Cedar Rapids at 610 2nd Avenue Southeast. And under Museum Art, Magic and Mystery, Mardi Gras, and Carnival Traditions. This exhibit will feature Czech and Slovak carnival masks and costumes next to ornate beaded parade costumes from the American South, along with Czech beaded necklaces. This is from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. today at the National Czech and Slovak Museum and Library in Cedar Rapids at 1400 Inspiration Place Southwest. The cost is free up to $10. And here's something about an upcoming event. Join Amanda's Holiday House Tour. The Amana Arts Guild's annual Holiday House Tour invites participants to explore both modern and historic Amana homes that homeowners have opened to the public and decorated for the occasion. The tour is scheduled for 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. December 3rd and 1 to 4 p.m. on December 4th. The tour will include four Amana homes as well as the Amana Heritage Society's Rudy Kitchen, which is an historic communal kitchen at 1003 26th Avenue, Middle Amana, and refreshments will be served at the Gallery on Main at 4502 220th Trail. The homes are from Ron and Vicki Conley at 3010 220th Trail in Middle Amana, Suzanne and Jeff Conquest House at 621 46th Avenue in Amana, the Katie and Bryce Steckley House at 3807 F Street in Amana, and the Bill and Christy Yoder Home at 2610 J Street, Middle Amana. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Monday, November 21st. I'm your reader, Kelly Neff. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.